Today is August 10th, 2012. Our study today is entitled Peace and Casual Friday. We've spent a lot of time in recent studies in John chapter 13, but I would just like to remind you of some of the gems that we uncovered there. We saw that the Lord, after the supper, it's entitled the Last Supper, that's how we refer to it, he rose up. He laid aside his garments. And I'm sure there's a lot of meaning in that. Then he took a towel and girded himself and began to wash the feet of his disciples. Peter, feeling offended because his Lord had presented himself so humbly, sought to forestall the Lord from washing his feet. And the Lord told him, you don't understand the meaning of this ceremony, of the sacrament. You'll understand it hereafter. And he said, if I wash you not, you have no part with me. Grapple with that for a second. We see that we are at a crossroads because the Lord drew a line in the sand, to use a metaphor. If you can't cross this line, we have to part our ways. I'm not so certain that such a demarcation of fellowship was ever expressed by the Lord. But Peter's response was remarkable, and the Lord's further response to that was remarkable. Peter said, then not my feet only, but wash me all over. And I like what the Lord said after that. He said, ye are clean in every whit. And we focused a little bit on how the disciples got clean. I think it's a fascinating statement that the Lord pronounced them clean, all but one. Of course, that was Judas. The only medium that was used to cleanse them was his testimony. That's how they became clean. The Lord says, you only need to have your feet washed now. If the feet washing was symbolic, as we know that it was, then we see that the Lord used a different medium to cleanse his disciples, which did not involve literally taking water and scrubbing them down. And this is why we need to understand the meaning of this sacrament delivered by Christ to the church, because he says that we ought to do this often one to another. He told them that if I be your Lord and you say, well, because I am, and I can wash your feet, then you ought to also be able to wash each other's feet. Clearly mandating that his disciples, and let it be not mistaken, this is a mandate for his disciples. Not the 120, not his friends, it was just the 12, his disciples. They are the ones that were given the commission to wash each other's feet. And then he says, if ye know these things, happy are ye if ye do them. You can't even receive happiness by knowing it. Your happiness will only come by doing it. But we know from this sacred ceremony that our hearts will well up with resistance. Therefore, it expresses the theme that we need to underline and underscore now, that we don't know what is best for our peace. We don't understand what it takes to be happy. But I look back through history and I see all that the Lord has done for humanity. And I know he's a genius at making us happy. Therefore, if we trust in him, then we will earnestly take hold of this ceremony as it is now first being unfolded and use it to attain and ascertain our happiness. Happiness is another word for peace. You may not have ever made that link and saw them as being synonyms, but they're almost perfect synonyms. it takes a little bit of analysis to discern. If you are running down the street from gangsters and they're trying to shoot you down, you may have $1 million in the bank, but you're not happy because your peace is disrupted. People that are at peace, they don't run to do anything. They just sit and are in a state of calmness. You need to make the connection between happiness and peace, because that leads you into David's work. He has given us insight into how we are going to garner our joy, our peace, and our happiness. What is it that's going to bring to us our happiness? If we understand the meaning of the feet washing experience, we know it, and then if we perform the meaning and do it, that leads to happiness. But the Lord is not here now to participate with us. Therefore, He sends His elect servant. Notice I didn't say your elected servant. He didn't give you a vote. That means that unless you are completely in harmony with Christ, you could face the challenge that you may not instinctively like the elect. But in verse 20 of John chapter 13, he says, "Verily, verily, I say unto you, he that receiveth whomsoever I send, receiveth me. And he that receiveth me, receiveth him that sent me." He says that shortly after he describes the happiness that we are to attain from this ceremony. But I think of happiness as the removal of restrictions and confinement. When you remove your socks and your shoes, when you open up the intimacies of your past history, the way that your feet have trod, and trust in the Lord to bring to you justification. This is needed because your mind is dominated with laws that are devoid of God's wisdom and of His Word. And therefore, some of the things that you feel inhibited about may not even be a violation of the law. And some of the things that you have done that have violated the law, we're going to see the Lord is going to clean that up. He's not going to justify your sins. He's not going to excuse your sins. But He's going to make you at peace with the path that you have trod. I think of the socks and shoes as being confining. But think of another illustration. Some of you ladies will be able to understand this. Think of a girdle. Don't you feel relieved when you come home and you relax and you free yourself from that confining attire? Let me show you an illustration. Let's read John chapter 12, verse 42 and 43. "Nevertheless, among the chief rulers, also many believed on him. But because of the Pharisees, they did not confess him." Take a special note here. We've identified now, perhaps for the first time in Bible history, perhaps not, we've zeroed in on two separate classes of distinguished people in the church: the rulers and the Pharisees. Evidently, they have to be mutually exclusive. One group doesn't pertain perfectly to the other group, because it says the rulers believed on Christ, but because of the Pharisees, they did not confess Him, lest they should be put out of the synagogue. For they loved the praise of men more than the praise of God. These rulers had power, they had authority, and they had preeminence, but they couldn't get past the theological block that was in their way. And that kept them, that restricted them from receiving Christ. Let me do something here that is unique in my study. Let me take a reversal of analysis and take a very definitive event and apply to it a proverb, a metaphor. That restriction on those chief rulers was like wearing a tightly constrictive girdle. You wore it to keep your body from freely relaxing. And so the chief rulers, they did not feel comfortable expressing their love for Christ. They were restricted. Hopefully that'll make some sense in a little while. But they allowed the Pharisees to define sins. And believe it or not, you've got in your mind offenses that burden you that are not based upon God's Word. And those things are keeping you away from the Lord. Somebody needs to look into your life and see the path that you have tread to free you from those false impressions of sin, from those embarrassing moments of isolation. David was different than the rulers. In fact, he was a special type of ruler. He took a completely different approach. David says in Psalms chapter 31, reading verses 11 through 13, I was a reproach among all my enemies, but especially among my neighbors, and a fear to mine acquaintances. They that did see me without fled from me. Now, when he says see me from without, that means they looked at his outward image, and they fled. I am forgotten as a dead man out of mind. I am like a broken vessel. For I have heard the slander of many. Fear was on every side. While they took counsel together against me, they devised to take away my life. David was similar in circumstance to the rulers that we just read about, but he had a different approach. He stood for the Lord, and he allowed everybody to see his position and his posture. And he absorbed the hate. He lived through the affliction and the oppression. It won for him enemies. And that's what this truth is designed to do, because it discerns who is really to be the legitimate rulers in God's house. Those that are able to withstand the derisions and the ridicule of the people that are opposed to Christ. Don't let somebody else, no matter how lofty their station, define for you sin and mock you because of reproach. I remember when we were young, I used to be embarrassed to drive up to church in my dad's car. That's an early example of how, because the car may not be as new and as polished and as nice as the other cars in the lot, you still got to go up and represent. You got to go up to the house of the Lord, and you've got to do so without any shame or reproach that is offensive to you. You got to withstand that pressure. But not so with the rulers that we just read. They were like Nicodemus. They cloaked their heart. Such men, what do they need? They didn't need to have their feet washed. They needed to be washed all over. The disciples graduated from that pressure. They became clean. And they reached a point where their peace was solely determined by the ordinance of humility. John chapter 13 is a wonderful chapter. After it describes the ordinance of humility, after it describes the fact that the Lord is going to send somebody that's going to represent Him, it gives us a new commission. Verse 34 and 35 says, a new commandment give I unto you, that ye love one another. As I have loved you, that ye also love one another. By this shall all men know that ye are my disciples, if ye have loved one to another. the disciples are commanded to love one another so the world can see. So the disciples does not reflect the people that are in the world. The disciples reflect the people that were sent to impress, to win, and to convert the people in the world. They have to have a special love one for another. This ordinance, this commission, this new commandment was given only after the ordinance was installed amongst them. And we know that it now symbolizes, by the removal of your socks and shoes, that the disciples are able to gain and garner a full knowledge of each other. Because you cannot love somebody unless you know them. And if people are fearful to come around you and fully express themselves, then your love is based merely on a facade. Your communion is not real. You may think you know a person, you may enjoy their company, but when they come around you, they have to hide who they are. They have to hide the path that they've trodden. Therefore, there's a barrier to keeping this commission. People are forced to dress, as it were, uncomfortably, with their spirits girded, and that precludes your close fellowship. But we're now reaching a day that was designed for Davidia to become more casual. That's why I refer to it as Davidia's casual day. In fact, I've entitled the study, Peace and Casual Friday. Those of you who have worked in an office may have had this experience. Office workers began what is now known as Casual Friday. At the end of the week, they dressed down. The intentions were good, but for the first time, you uncovered much of the reality of your co-workers without the veneer. If anything could kill fantasies of an office romance, it was Casual Friday. All of a sudden, the spouse you had at home didn't look so bad. Meticulous grooming is replaced with a more relaxed dress code. The perfume, gone. Short dresses with sheer stockings, no more. The girdle, left at home. The real face exposed. The makeup and the makeovers removed. Restrictive attire replaced with loose-fitting, comfort clothing. And the good qualities became hidden, while the imperfections became exposed. Somebody knows what I'm talking about up in here. It's often not a pretty picture, but haven't we been kidding ourselves spiritually? Every marriage, every communion and fellowship eventually devolves into casual day. I can exaggerate here to make a point. Suppose in the office, face not washed, hair not combed, teeth not brushed, showers not taken. For our purpose, this is the reality for the family, but not for the public eye. The ordinance of humility is Davidia's Casual Friday. Though it removes the facade, it employs a better tactic. If your love can survive this, then you've got a good marriage. Such is Christ's way to truly make you socially acceptable. With socks and shoes removed, He cleanses you. He gives you the makeover and bonds you together in real love. He legitimizes you as a redeemed sinner so that the brethren see you just as you are without one plea. Christ grooms you with, as David put it in Psalms 51, truth in the inward parts and in the hidden parts. David said, wash me thoroughly from my iniquity and cleanse me from my sin. Behold, thou desirest truth in the inward parts, and in the hidden parts thou shalt make me to know wisdom. Psalm 51, verse 2 and 6. Christ turns your crimps to purity. Then, to complete the makeover, He gives to you His glory, His power that Father gave to Him. We've read about that often in John 17. And from that purge, you will receive immediate, unquestionable respect. Was not the same done for Peter, Paul, Mary, the woman at the well, etc., we know their defects and still respect them. Then, while elevated upon that cloud, you can convey to the world his higher standard of beauty, a standard formally concealed by society's false allure. If you do not think that this is a real barrier to salvation, ask yourself, why did Adam and Eve seek to hide their nakedness from Christ? They, like militant Davidia today, had a perverse idea of beauty. Sometimes you think that you are ugly because you don't know how to see. You need your mind washed. Then at the end of the testimony, the cleansing must be complete. You do not need socks and shoes when he washes your history, when he purifies your path. In this you become presentable. You are no longer uptight and secretive. Standing in his righteousness, you're free from human opinion. And this, even though you are casual, this is akin to an open, not secret society initiation. It certifies you to be sent. Then a disciple, those who truly are your eternal co-workers, will see you and love you just as you are. Now please don't get me wrong. In reality, as we find occasion to meet, we will still strive to be groomed presentably. But our hearts must become casual. The world's peace, my Christ, is based on a facade. Thus, they never come to real love. Instead, they eternalize pretense. And when a fault is ultimately made known, they, the presumed family, friends, and associates, resort, often unbeknownst to the newly made vulnerable person, to ridicule and gossip. They are steeped in pretentious love. It is this that we, formerly disconnected to Christ, have learned to fear. And that fear has caused us to hide from each other. With this barrier eternally removed, we receive real communion. We receive our unity. This novel Davidic approach to our appearance was described by David when he said, I was a reproach among all mine enemies, but especially among my neighbors, and a fear to my acquaintances. They that did see me without fled from me. As we seek to expand upon this a little deeper, let me remind you that there are at least two classes of people that are grouped in this final salvation story. There are the students and the teachers. This leads to what some may have spurned a double standard. And there you go again. Just because somebody calls something a double standard, automatically we think that it's wrong. The Bible never said, thou shalt not have a double standard. Let us base our thoughts upon Bible reality. Our mission as Mustard Seed Adventists is to teach. Let's go to Psalms chapter 51. Verse 2, David speaks to the washing. He says, wash me thoroughly from mine iniquity and cleanse me from my sin. Verse 13, then will I teach transgressors thy way, and sinners shall be converted unto thee. Notice here, I mentioned two separate groups, at least two. You have David, and you have those that are supposed to teach. We could go to Jeremiah 3, and we could clearly see a deepening of this theme whereby the Lord promised that Israel, once they return, he will give them pastors after his own heart. That's a synonym for Davidian pastors. He says, and they shall feed you with knowledge and understanding. And that's what David is referring to. And this is the reason for the ordinance of humility. This is the reason why we have to remove our shoes and socks. Ungird ourselves and wash each other's feet. Consider an experience that we all share as an example. The roller coaster ride. It's safe, joyous, but unnerving. People flock to the amusement parks for the same reason that they seek communion, to joy and companionship while being entertained. These rides for fun twist you and turn you, lift you and drop you, shake you and jolt you, jump you and dump you. So to board, they warn you to secure all loose items. Having failed to do so, at the end of the ride, reality can strike you. Your wife's perm is now distressed. Her false eyelash is gone. Her weave blown away. Her makeup smeared. Her false teeth missing. Her breast implants out of place. Her prosthetic limb lost. Come on now. I know I'm exaggerating, but the point is real. What you thought to be a joy ride becomes a nightmare. Formerly dazed by the ride, you come to your balance and look at the person next to you and horrified exclaim, "Who are you? What have you done with my spouse?" The people whom you wish would unite with this work will not do so, for the Lord knows their true identity. They are people whom he cannot wash to do your job. They cannot teach the transgressors and to convert the sinner. And before you take this excursion, before you board this ride, you would do well to know the people with whom you're communing. We could learn a lesson from that. It would be different if salvation was only for godly folks. That was Christ's original idea, you know. Do you know that? Well, we're going to learn a little bit about Christ. He said, "Learn of me," didn't he? Okay, let's turn to Numbers. In fact, Christ and Israel had their own roller coaster ride. They got out there in the wilderness and discovered things about each other they didn't know before. In Numbers chapter 14, verse 11 and 12, "And the Lord said unto Moses, how long will this people provoke me?" They annoyed him. They provoked him. "How long will it be ere they believe me for all the signs which I have shown among them? I will smite them with the pestilence and disinherit them. And I will make of thee," speaking of Moses, "a greater nation and mightier than they." And Moses objected. But we have no reason to not believe that this was the sentiments of the Lord's heart. We need to think and reflect upon the marvels of Christ and how he suffers to do the Father's will. Because as we know, he continued on to lead his people. But it gives you a window into our path of dividing the word of truth. As we turn to John chapter 12, we just left there, didn't we? Let's read verse 44. "Jesus cried and said, he that believeth on me, believeth not on me." What type of double talk is that? You're learning of the Lord, aren't you? To believe on him means you don't believe on him. "He that believeth on me, believeth not on me, but on him that sent me." I told you we're rightly dividing the word truth. The Old Testament scriptures represent Christ and his sentiments. That was his church. It was his inheritance. He governed them by virtue of his personality. But then, as he promised, he rested upon Jesus and spoke through Jesus. And what in essence said is, the themes that I'm teaching you now that you have to believe are not from me, but they're from the Father. We have a division, therefore, in the Word. Now, understand that the Father gave affirmation to the Old Testament scriptures. He gave credence to the laws and the prophecies, but we adhere to those now merely because of Jesus' testimony, because he pointed us back to those things. But they're only validated because the testimony of Jesus pronounced them valid. Thus, if you believe on Christ, you're not believing on Christ. Your only concept of Christ was that which was revealed through Jesus. And he did not reveal his own will, but he expressed the sentiments of the Father. In fact, in John chapter 8, he said, I have other things to judge of you, but he that sent me is true, and I speak only those things which he has commanded me to say. He continues with that same theme here in John chapter 12. Let's read a little bit more. If any man hear my words and believe not, I judge him not, for I came not to judge the world, but to save the world. He that rejecteth me and receiveth not my words hath one that judgeth him. The word that I have spoken, the same shall judge him in the last day. The words that he spoke is going to judge in the last day. For I have not spoken of myself. I told you, didn't I? But the Father which sent me, he gave me a commandment, what I should say and what I should speak. And I know that his commandment is life everlasting. Whatsoever I speak, therefore, even as the Father has said unto me, so I speak. That's John 12, verse 47 through 50. Therefore, we need to understand that the testimony of Jesus is an addendum to the law. It doesn't remove the law. It makes it applicable so that the entire world can receive salvation. And that's so important. And that's what Paul meant when he said, a workman that needeth not to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth. You can't discount the law and the testimonies. We learn that from Matthew 5. But I reiterate, you cannot do so because the Father, through Christ, commanded that you not do so. Hopefully that's clear. Let me take you to Romans chapter 11. We're talking about the love that we're going to have for one another. We see that that's going to unite us. Therefore, when David says in Psalm 51, after his sins are washed, then will he teach the transgressors and the ungodly. We refer to, from Jeremiah chapter 3, how Davidia is going to do that. Pastors after the Lord's own heart is going to do that. But both David and Jeremiah were right in their descriptions because the disciples will be united. They will not be established on a principle of sophistry and of pretension. Their peace will result from their casual connection with each other. Paul speaks of the day when this is going to occur. He speaks of the day when David's commission is going to be to teach the ungodly. And I think that we've got it sort of twisted now. We thought that the Lord, by our Adventist experience, was wholly focused on godly people. His mission was not to save the godly. His mission was to save the ungodly. He needs a ministry to convert ungodly to become godly. Therefore, when you expose your flaws, then the ungodly can say, I can see that now. 11:25 of Romans. For I would not, brethren, that ye should be ignorant of this mystery, lest ye should be wise in your own conceit, that blindness is in part happened to Israel, until the fullness of the Gentiles be come in. And so all Israel shall be saved. Imagine that. All Israel shall be saved. These are the people whom the Lord scattered in all the nations. Saved. As it is written, there shall come out of Zion the deliverer. Don't be walking around boasting about how your church is the highest church on planet Earth, because God's movement is only going to leave that behind. The highest theological point is Mount Zion. That's the place anciently where the church was established. But Paul affirms what Isaiah chapter 55 also teaches, what the Bible teaches through and through, that there shall come out of Zion the deliverer, and shall turn away ungodliness from Jacob. And this is why we have the ordinance of humility. For this is my covenant unto them, when I shall take away their sins. Paul tells you that it's not only what's going to happen, it was covenanted to happen. But it's one thing to handle this doctrine theoretically. Let us make it real. I can't address all the sins in one study. Let me just see if I can identify one, maybe two, that we all look at with great disdain. And we can now take pause as our feet touch the ground, as we remove the veneer that has covered us we can discern whether it's right or wrong. With David, and I'm referring to the son that was promised to him, you can prevail just as you are. He was ordained as the light to recover you. I think of an illustration that my wife and I, as we're going through this personal ministry, have touched on. And don't worry, Vanette, I don't think this is going to embarrass you too much. But before she met me, she went through a spiritual trauma and a trial in England. Back in the day, maybe 32 years ago, there was the charismatic movement that swept the church, and people were questioning Adventist theology, and they were doing so from Paul's teaching. And they were teaching that, quote unquote, you're no longer under the law, you shouldn't be legalistic, and that you should not be so careful to guard against eating clean and unclean meats. It's all blessed, it's all good, you see. And that you don't have to worry about going and honoring the Sabbath day to keep it holy. And Vanette got caught up in this. Now, one thing that impressed me about Vanette, and I've known this since we married, is she prayed for two basic things, for salvation, and she prayed to preserve her virginity. And the Lord delivered her to me in my embrace with those two things intact. But by virtue of the fact that she strayed from Adventist theology for that short period of time, that's a part of her path that needs to be confessed. What we're discerning now is that David comes and doesn't ignore it, so that she has to hide from it. She sees that as part of the path that she tread. The light of David came. There's nobody in Christendom, and I don't say this boastfully, that can expose the fallacies of that charismatic movement more so than me. The Lord has opened up to me an understanding of Paul's work and has shown me that the world doesn't understand the meaning of his teachings. But as we have the light of Israel, we can see and pierce more deeply into his work and discern that he's in complete harmony with the Bible. Therefore, I was able to rescue Vanette from that, and she became a devout Adventist, more so than she'd ever been before, as a result of that experience. Therefore, she doesn't need to lament the fact that she boldly took a nervous move and ate a piece of swine at the behest of these people, and that she went to church on Sunday a couple times. She could look back at that and say, thank you, Father, for rescuing me from that misstep. Why should she cover that up? Why should she ignore it? You never knew this about Vanette. When you see her, you sit down and talk with her, she would never bring that up. But now she can. Her feet have been washed. Like I said, with David, he was elected to be the light to recover you. The scriptures tell us this. Let me quickly go through a few. 2 Chronicles 21:7. Howbeit, the Lord would not destroy the house of David because of the covenant that he had made with David, and as he promised to give a light to him and to his sons forever. 1 Kings 11:36. And unto his son will I give one tribe, that David my servant may have a light always before me in Jerusalem, the city which I have chosen me to put my name there. The Lord elected the son of David to be a light in Jerusalem forever. What's this about Jerusalem? It's an important place. It's an important place because it's the setting of what the Bible refers to as the great king, referring to the son of David. Look and see. Matthew 5:34-35. But I say unto you, swear not at all, neither by heaven. Why can't you swear by heaven, Lord? For it is God's throne. Nor by earth, for it is his footstool. Neither by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Evidently, a contradistinction is made between the Father and the great king. Jerusalem is the city of the great king. And we saw that's the son of David. We're talking about the realities and the dynamics of your life when your feet are washed and you're made free. The best I can think of is David himself. How shall he be justified? Have you ever given any thought to that? you know that when David comes up in the kingdom, and he promises that he will, he's going to meet Uriah, and he's going to meet Bathsheba. They'll not be married and given into marriage to the resurrected, but these people will be in the kingdom. How is it that David is going to look them in the face? You ever wonder that? Now, I ask that question with his statement as a backdrop. Wash me, and I shall be whiter than snow. He asked the Lord, he implored the Lord to wash him of his sin. When he comes forward in the resurrection, the Lord has to fulfill that. He's washed of his sin because the Son of David, the light of Israel, is there. And he is able to make pleasant his bad experience. If he could do that for David, he can do that for you too. Uriah was a Hittite. The Hittites were one of the seven nations that the Lord commanded that they all be destroyed and that they be not left. And David speaks to this because these were people, all seven of these nations, sacrificed their own children. They'd be hard-pressed to argue in the judgment that they were dealt harshly with since they cut off their own posterity. And the Lord did not want Israel to devolve in human sacrifices and be corrupted. He didn't condemn all the Canaanites, but he condemned the seven nations. Israel violated that commission, and Uriah was able to withstand. When Uriah comes forward in the resurrection, and he sees that he's the only one of the Hittites, perhaps, that's remaining, he'll recognize God's provisions and his glory. Sure, it was wrong for David to covet his wife, but why was that wrong? Let's turn to 2 Samuel. When Uriah comes forward, he will not be able to regather with his wife anyhow. But he'll at least have the benefit of eternal salvation. Even though David, by subterfuge, fulfilled his commission and took his life. 2 Samuel chapter 12, verse 13 and 14. And David said unto Nathan, I have sinned against the Lord. And Nathan said unto David, the Lord also hath put away thy sin. Thou shalt not die. Howbeit, because this deed thou hast given great occasion to the enemies of the Lord to blaspheme, the child also that is born unto thee shall surely die. There was another battle at stake. Israel, when they went to destroy the nations, they were not to confiscate any of their goods. Not their cattle, not their children, not their wives. They were all to be destroyed. And the reason for that being, as I'm working on in my written study on the peace offering, the reason for that was that it would look as if Christ was collecting to himself the goods of the people that worship the devil. And that is the wherewithal by which he established his kingdom. Thus, when the Lord punished David because he has given great occasion for his enemies to blaspheme the Lord, he's referring to the spiritual world. He's referring to the demons. He's referring to Lucifer, Satan, the accuser of the brethren. To say, aha, this is a man after the Lord's own heart. And this is why he sent Israel to destroy the Hittites, so that they could selfishly appropriate to themselves their goods. That was a major insult to the Lord, that his king should conduct himself thusly. And this is the reason why David was penalized. But now we see that as he is resurrected, the Lord will wash him of his sin. He was justified in killing the Hittites. That was part of his commission. But he did not have a commission to secure for himself their goods. In fact, the mustard seed advent now has the duty and responsibility to wash all those that are going to become entrants into the kingdom. They're going to come through the influence of the disciples. But we have to understand that it must also wash all the New Testament prophets whose feet have not been washed. Understand what I say when I say wash. They all have reproaches against them. They all have indictments by which people accuse and assail them. The Lord has to make clean all those who've been eternal participants in His work. But get this, including Paul. Paul was one of the 12 disciples whose feet were not originally washed by the Lord. And as a result, his writings and his work has brought nothing but confusion. Not because he wasn't inspired by the Holy Spirit. It brought confusion because we didn't understand. We needed the light of Israel to discern for us his meaning. And therefore, the mustard seed harmonizes Paul's work with the Bible. It legitimizes it. It brings forward that which none else could do. It makes his work palatable. He shows you that he was basically inspired to feed the church milk doctrine. And he told you quite clearly why nobody else has picked up on this is a testimony to the Father. He told you that strong meat would come and the milk doctrines would be done away. Therefore, it's futile for anyone to quote Paul as an advancing step in the gospel today. Paul, when he said, we're no longer under the law, well, the Gentile world was never under the law. He's referring to under the curse of the law. Moses pronounced curses on Israel if they would abandon their covenant. He said, I leave before you a choice to choose blessings or cursings, but I know you're going to choose the cursings. Those people from the Hebrew nation that rejected Christ fell under the curses of the law. But those who joined Christianity were freed from the curse of the law. And this is what Vinette and her friends needed to understand 32 years ago. Therefore, we could highlight Paul's falterings. And let's face it, there's a lot of division and confusion in the church. There is no unity because we don't know how to rightly divide the word of truth and because we put the wrong emphasis on Paul's work. He's the only one of the gospel writers that calls into question, not by his work, but by how his work is interpreted, the legitimacy of the law. The Christian church needs to be washed of that experience. And that's part of the feet washing communion service that we seek to perform. I think of one sin that haunts us. And that is the sin, that is the reproach of abortion. That's where a woman decides that she can't take this child. This is not a recent episode in human history. This has happened all throughout history. And she aborts the child. The Pope defined that as sin because the Pope considered babies to be righteous. We've confused righteousness with helplessness. And people say, oh, the little baby is helpless and therefore he should be protected. Now, the mustard seed advent does not advocate abortion, but it certainly knows how to wash you if that has been your experience. You can't let the Pope define sin. We're told in Deuteronomy chapter 10 what the Lord requires of you. Let's read that. This is important because it summarizes his requisite of his entire law. This is an overriding emphasis of the entire duty of Israel to the law. And now, Israel, what doth the Lord thy God require of thee? But to fear the Lord thy God, to walk in all his ways, and to love him, and to serve the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, to keep the commandments of the Lord and his statutes, which I command thee this day for thy good. If you've been given reason to become distressed over a pregnancy, and you could discern that it's not for your own good, then though somebody else may disagree with you, the Lord has given you the ability and the requirement, the requisite, to make that decision. This didn't fall to us under Jesus' administration. But the Lord tells us in Matthew chapter 11, my yoke is easy and my burden is light. They say, but that's killing. If it were killing, then that merely is a violation of the Ten Commandments for your own good. But it has not been established that it is killing. It's based upon a papal doctrine, a spiritualism, where they believe at the moment of conception, a spirit from heaven enters you. We know that that's not biblical because Gabriel referred to Jesus. If anybody would be a human being at conception, you would think it would be him. But he referred to him as that holy thing that shall be conceived within you. Not a person, but a thing. Now, the Lord knows that most women are struggling to have children. They're not looking for abortion. Therefore, there must be some great distress that would cause them to abort their children. I understand that in the slave passage, the women who were brought over here didn't want their children born into slavery, so they aborted their babies. They did that for their own good. But abortion was actually mandated in the law. If this has been one of the things that has afflicted you, this has been a reproach for you, then you need to have your peace. You need to be brought into a more casual peace, and you need to be calm, because it's a reproach. It's not a sin. Leviticus 20 lists all type of things where people should be killed. It tells you that if you curse your mother and father, you should be killed. If you commit adultery, you should be killed. And we see an expanded definition of adultery. Remember, the father's testimony, the men's Christ testimony, and he defines this entire generation as being adulterous. There are people that are involved in adultery, they don't even know they're involved in adultery. And they don't even bother to confess that. It actually says, they shall be put to death. But then, we have this one text. It says, I'm reading Leviticus chapter 20, verse 21. And if a man shall take his brother's wife, it is an unclean thing. He hath uncovered his brother's nakedness. They shall be childless. Didn't say they should be killed. It said they should be childless. The only way that they could guarantee that they could be childless, they didn't have birth control pills in that day, was if the child were aborted. I want to connect this study with the atonement, because the atonement is our ultimate peace. You need to understand that the Lord removed, by Father's testimony, the death penalty from the church. The elders are no longer constrained to kill people. He that is without sin, let him cast the first stone. Jesus is the only one that is without sin. He's the one that will adjudicate whether you are destroyed because of your sin. Because we haven't had the light of David to inform us as to what's right, what's wrong, what's good, or what's bad, we assume that because somebody received the death penalty, that means that they could no longer be resurrected and be saved in the Lord's kingdom. But we've ignored the fact that the atonement was the designated protocol to discern who receives salvation and who does not. And the atonement was designed to remove all your sins. I'm referring to Ezekiel 25, verse 10, 21, and 22. And they shall make an ark of shittim wood, and thou shalt put the mercy seat above upon the ark. That's the place where you garner mercy. And in the ark thou shalt put the testimony that I shall give thee. He tells you, Israel was supposed to construct an ark and put a testimony that I shall give you in the ark, indicating that he wasn't through speaking to them. Even though the law was declared earlier from Sinai, as described in Exodus chapter 20. And thou shalt put the mercy seat above upon the ark, and in the ark thou shalt put the testimony that I shall give thee, and there will I meet with thee. The Lord promises to meet with them at the mercy seat. That's the place where sinners get mercy. But was this just applicable to Israel? Let's see. And Aaron shall bring the bullock of the sin offering. I'm in Leviticus chapter 16. I'm reading verse 11, verse 29, and then verse 30. And Aaron shall bring the bullock of the sin offering, and shall kill the bullock of the sin offering. And he shall put the incense upon the fire before the Lord, that the cloud of the incense may cover the mercy seat that is upon the testimony. Verse 14. And he shall take of the blood of the bullock, and sprinkle it with his fingers upon the mercy seat. Verse 29. And this shall be a statute forever unto you. For how long? Forever. Whether it be one of your own country, or a stranger that sojourneth among you. This was a statute that was pertinent not just to the Hebrews, but to the world. To make an atonement for the children of Israel for all their sins. The testimony was put in the ark. The mercy seat was set above it. And by the officiation of the high priest, we would receive communion with the Lord, and he would extend to us mercy. Therefore, people who committed adultery, people who committed sodomy, people who have committed cursings to their parents, people who married inconveniently, like Abraham, people such as that, on the Day of Atonement, will have their sins removed. Of course, the benefit from that, the deceased will have to be resurrected. Of course, we get into trouble as we begin to rationalize, and we say that God put the baby there, therefore you're violating God's will by so doing. But their moral objections are not based upon the light of David. While the baby was born deformed, God made him that way. You hear that. The Lord has saddled us with a lot of burdens and problems. Not because the burdens and problems are just and right, but because he wants to lead us on his path to the kingdom. We saw that in John 9 with the blind man. They wanted to know why he was blind. And Christ said God had blinded him for his own glory. And we saw how that happened because the Lord was able to heal him. David was likewise born with his reproaches. He was born that way. And it broke his heart. But he gave Christ the credit. He said that the Lord did it for his sake. That text is so riveting to me that I want you to read that directly. Psalms chapter 37. I'm reading verse 3. Trust in the Lord and do good. Automatically you see what you need to do. You thought all this time, because it was a cliche that rolled off your lips, that you trusted in the Lord. Such has not been the case if you haven't learned of the Lord. Now, I refer you to Luke chapter 24, verse 44, where we're informed, and also in Mark chapter 12, where it says, David called Christ Lord. Whence then is he his son? I want you to keep that in mind as you read this, because this is what we're understanding now. We're told to trust in the Lord, which means that we need to trust in Christ. And do good. So shalt thou dwell in the land, and verily thou shalt be fed. Those who reject the testimony of Jesus, I don't know what land they think they're going to dwell in, but it's not the land of promise. And if they're not going to dwell in the promised land, then they're certainly not going to go up to heaven. How do you go up to heaven if you don't trust in the Lord? Your commission, therefore, is to trust in the Lord. Receive his judgments. And the only way that you can receive his judgments, you've proven through your 30, 50, 90 years of life, you don't have the capacity to discern what's good and what's bad. You're haunted with everybody else's judgments. He sends you a light, the light of Israel, the one whom he promised to send his disciples so that he could pick up again on the ordinance of humility and give to them their peace. Delight thyself, verse 4, also in the Lord, and he shall give thee the desires of thy heart. Some folks think, well, I only ask the Lord for what I need. I don't ask him for what I want. Well, automatically, you're missing the point. He wants to give you the desires of your heart. He'll do it too. Commit thy way unto the Lord. Trust also in him, and he shall bring it to pass. And he shall bring forth thy righteousness as the light, and thy judgment as the noonday. If you made decisions in your life that others recriminate against, that others besmirch, and that others ridicule, but they are not condemned by the law, then the Lord calls that your righteousness, and he's going to vindicate you. If you trust in the Lord, if you learn of him, he shall bring forth thy righteousness as the light, and thy judgment as the noonday. Abortion is just one example. Another example that people are haunted with, that they need to have washed, because there has been an upswell, and you're going to be shocked at this when I say this, over the last century, there are people that will rebel against this word because they harbor racism in their hearts. The Lord commanded that you love the disciples. If you come into this work, that is your commission. And your commission from your commissioner is that you go to rescue Jerusalem. You may have spent 70 years at war with them, but all that is a sin. Let's not blow it out of proportion. I remember telling people before I even understood this in the Seventh-day Adventist Church, went to the black church. They would complain how they would go to the white church and they would always send them off to somewhere else. Yeah, it happened to us. We went up to Erie. We searched out an Adventist church. We went there and they said, oh, you want the black church. There's a red around the corner there. And that's what they said. And people take offense to that. But if you take offense to it, that's all it is a reproach. That's all it is a sin. The Lord does say you should love your neighbor as yourself. But like any other sin, that can be wiped out. Believe it or not, the Lord may want to reach out to some people that belong to the KKK. As hard as it is for me to say that because of their animus towards me and my family, I can't personalize the gospel to me. Therefore, if there's anybody in this clan, in this group, that has a problem with these things, then you need to sit with me and let me wash you. We'll straighten you out. We'll show you what David said, trust in the Lord. He sends you out to his afflicted. That's an honor. You'll be seated on the cloud calling them up. They're not distinguished and they're not likable to you because that's the way that God cursed them. Now, I didn't say that he cursed them black. I said he cursed them because they violated his law and he made them obnoxious to the nations. That was part of the curse in Deuteronomy 28. If they weren't obnoxious, people would like them and they wouldn't receive their punishment. These things have to be put into perspective. And this is what the feet washing experience is all about. Because the Lord is going to assemble family and we've got to uncover what each and every one of us is like. You know how folks are in your family. Some people are grumpy. You make room for them, don't you? Some people have got fetishes and got, you don't dismiss them from the family, you include them in love. That's your commission, to love one another. And casual Friday for Davidia is the day when we take on a lighter yoke, a lighter burden, when we take off the girdle, when we take off the restrictions, when we let the world see who we are. Not because we want to be all the more hated, but because we know that the Lord is going to declare our righteousness. And that he is going to lift us up. And therefore, we now can become more relaxed in our communion and in our unity. We can now seek to embrace each other just as they are. Joy over the path that they have trod. Know by your faith that God has brought them that way. Know that he led you. I think of that proverb, you've heard footprints in the sand, where somebody envisioned they're talking to Jesus and they only saw their footprints, one set of footprints, and they said, well, Lord, why did you abandon me? And he said, I didn't abandon you, I carried you. No. Those were your footprints through that trouble. That's the way he led you. But by virtue of that pathway, you've entered into his kingdom. If you've learned to relish the way that he has led you, and if you learn to trust in the Lord, then he will direct your path, and he will bring to you redemption. And with that, I bring the study to a close.